This morning I went to visit Louisa's cats. She brought her two cats with her from Lisbon and Porto, because the cats live in both places. So. Yesterday they came from Lisbon, right?
Yeah.
And they were hiding the cats. And Lisa said, I have a cat myself. I've always had cats, and I love them, and I'm familiar with them. So I could have guessed why they were hiding, but Lisa said they were hiding because they didn't know the room. And it was not familiar. And then also this person that they didn't know was also there. And she said that when they go from Lisbon to Porto, they don't have a problem because they know those two places. They're familiar places. And this is a very good illustration of what we all have, this experience, like the cats, of being frightened in a place that's unfamiliar, and wanting to be in a place that we know. It's important for the cats to stay in that one room, because then they will become more comfortable with that room. And if they lived in this place all the time, they could probably at some point run freely, and there would be no problem. They would recognize the place, and they would expand their knowledge and their experience of what is familiar. And this is a very clear example of our experience in life, of how we proceed in life. Last night, when I was explaining to the people who are here for the first time a very basic general idea of what the practice is, what we're doing here, I said we are trying to be aware, present, here, now. Something like that. Which is true, that is the basic element of this practice. The notions of what is here, what is now, what is presence and present, what is me, however, are not that basic. We have fixed ideas of what those are. We're familiar with certain places. We're familiar with this place that we call ourself. We're familiar with the places that this self goes and functions, and we're familiar with some of the other places we visit, the people we visit, like the cats are familiar with some people and places and not with others. And like the cats, we are frightened of what we don't recognize, what's not familiar. So when our idea of here is broken, or here no longer corresponds to our idea, then we become frightened, destabilized, uncomfortable, and we need to, once again, make it familiar. We need to know, we need to make it small, almost. The cats need that small room to become comfortable again. But here is what makes here, in our concept, in our idea, here is the walls. So here, this room, is here because there are these walls. If we take away the wall, then here also includes that next room, which is no longer the next room. It's here. If we take away this wall, here now includes what we think now of as outside. But it's only outside because we've made a wall that says this is inside and that's outside. If we take away we heard people walking across the floor. If we take that ceiling away, here extends up. There is no upstairs then. It's all here. And this is what we do with everything. We do this first with me. We build walls so that we can identify who me is, what this place is. This is a necessary process for a baby, for a child, to establish some sense of identity. It has to separate from its mother, the baby. That's the reality, that's life. If it didn't separate from its mother, it would not survive. It thinks it's the opposite, that it needs its mother for survival, and it does, but it also needs to separate, because if it doesn't separate, it will not grow. If the baby stays in the mother's stomach, both of them will die. The baby needs to come out and separate. But what happens is we mistake this very necessary process of separating so that we can grow, and we think that if we clear way of saying it. We limit our experience of our being to that separation. That's one aspect of our being, the differences. We all look different. We all have different eyes, hair, face. We all, even the digital print of our finger is different. The DNA is different. Our cells are different. Everything is different from others. But the nature of being is one. The walls, okay, we have these walls so that maybe we don't have so much noise, we don't have the cold coming in, we don't have the rain, we don't have wild animals. For many reasons, we build walls so we can live somewhere. But that doesn't mean that there isn't something else. The sky is endless. These walls we build don't take that away. When the clouds cover the sun is still there, but there's cloud cover, that's true. So this aspect of our being that is separate or different is one aspect. The other aspect is the oneness, the unity. You can think of it as the ocean. There are many waves in the ocean, and each wave looks different. There are some big ones, there are small ones, there are deep ones, shallow ones. Some of them have white foam on them, some of them don't. Some are wide, some are very small. The effects of these waves are different. A huge tsunami will come crashing across the land and destroy everything in its path. A tiny little wave on the beach will just wash up on the beach and then disappear. But each of these very different manifestations come from and are part of one body of water. And you can't separate the waves really from the ocean. They have distinctive manifestations, but they're all one. They're all part of this one body of water. And ultimately, you can't separate them. That's the same for us. We are each waves manifesting in a different way, but we're all part of one body. What keeps us from being present to whatever is here now is the walls that we put up, the separations that we create. So the cats, for example, again, the cats are so occupied with their fear and they are so attentive to any strange new sound, and each sound or person or, I don't know, change in light maybe even, smell, they're very attentive to smell. Each new different one is a potential danger. So they don't really appreciate, we don't really know because cats function differently than us, but I'm using this as a metaphor. So they don't really appreciate, so the cats were afraid of me. So they couldn't really appreciate the interest I had for them and the love and attraction that I had for them. They couldn't really appreciate that. I understand that. We do this, though, all of us. This is an example of what we do in our life. We don't really experience what is here because we are so attentive to the dangers, and I say dangers in a very vast way. Everything is a potential threat to me. Everything is, what does that person want from me? Or what can I get from that person? Usually these are the two very basic aspects of our relationships. And it can be very subtle. We're very sophisticated beings, humans. And the mind is very, very astute and clever. But it really comes down to that. What can I get to affirm me, to confirm that I am me and that I am good? Or what is that person trying to take from me so that I won't be good, so that I won't be strong, so that I will lose who I am? These are generally the two basic ideas of how we function. And both of them are born from the same idea that I am this place that is walled in. And I need to keep making the walls bigger so that I can protect it. Put on more locks. Build stronger, thicker, higher walls. Devise different methods of keeping people away. Or drawing them in because they will help me become a bigger, better, stronger me that can therefore keep other people away and or attract more people. So you see, it all comes from this basic idea that me needs to constantly be fed, needs constantly be protected, which comes from the very basic, our very tiny infancy, when it was true. We needed to be fed, we needed to be protected. Our survival depended on it. And we still do need to eat, and we still do need to protect ourselves. However, what is it that we're protecting? This is what we don't see. Who is this? Who is inside these walls? Who needs to build these walls? Who is eating? who is wanting to survive? What does survival mean? All of this very basic point about this question of who, when we haven't looked at it, and we haven't awakened to what the what and who really is, then we end up with a global financial crisis. And it's not a very far stretch. The problems that have exploded in our face with money and everything that comes with it come directly from this same place of not seeing who and what. Our whole society is basically constructed around an illusion of a solid, fixed self that needs to be affirmed by youth, possession, success, fame, beauty, a certain concept of beauty, a certain concept of youth. I had lunch last week with a friend who's 91. And she is one of the most youthful people I know, at the age of 91. We all have immense riches. We all are extremely wealthy. And yet we are looking into the fancy restaurant, watching the people eat, consume, drive in their fancy cars, thinking that they have everything and we have nothing. When in fact, we have a huge treasure, which is ourself. It's not the self we think, however. The true, which I'm talking about, the true self, which is a greater treasure than any jewel or bank account or villa on the Mediterranean. So I'm sitting here and I'm telling you all of this. And everyone's listening, and apparently no problem. It's important to say it. It's important for me to say it. It's important for you to hear it. But even more important is for each one to experience it. And that, my words, no matter how much I would love to have my words have some effect, they won't. This is a failed enterprise that I'm engaged in. And I know that. And I keep doing it. Because there's nothing else to do. And I don't know. The more I don't know the effects that my words will have, and the more you don't know what the effects the words will have, the more effects there will be. Because what keeps us from realizing what I'm talking about, and I'm talking about me and you, I'm not just talking about you, or I'm not just talking about me, we're in this together. What keeps us from realizing it, from awakening, we say, to this true self, is our expectations and our beliefs and our concepts and our attachments to those concepts and those ideas. We come here and we think, okay, I will sit here and I will feel really good and I will be relaxed and I will be friendly, and everyone will be nice, and I will go home at the end of the week and feel good, and it will be easy to go back to work. know. Maybe. We don't know. No one knows what will happen in the next minute, even. It certainly won't be what you think it will be, because what you think is just an idea. You may experience something that is similar to what you thought, but it won't be what you thought. And the less that you hang on to what you think should happen, the more what you really want to happen will happen. Does this make... It maybe doesn't make any sense, but... because the nature of what we're seeking is what cannot be planned, cannot be controlled. That's where our freedom is. It's pretty obvious when we think about it. We don't want to be controlled. We want to be free. Well, so then the answer is very simple. Stop trying to control things, including yourself. Stop trying to control what you think, what you do, what you say, where you go. And the control is very subtle. It's mostly, I shouldn't do this, or I should do that. Or, if I do this, people won't love me. If I do this, people will love me. These are all ways of controlling yourself and controlling others. And that results from, the walls are a result of that trying to control. Again, the cats. I'm thinking of my own cat, who I live in a house with. It's in the city, but there is a garden in the back. And there's also a house next door with a garden. And then beyond that there are others, and there are walls between the houses and the gardens, but that doesn't stop the cat. And my cat is very comfortable everywhere in my house, in our, her house. We say often it's her house and she allows us to live there, the cat. She's very comfortable throughout the house. She's very comfortable in her garden. She also thinks the garden next door is hers, and the people next door, it's the Zen center, she's, for them it's fine too. In the other gardens, I don't know. I've never seen her in the other gardens. But for the other cats in the neighborhood as well, it's very clear that these two gardens are hers. Other cats come through and sometimes try to take over. I don't think they want to take over her territory, but try to stay in her territory. But no, she eventually gets them out. Now, if Louisa's cats came there, they would probably find one corner of one room and hide. Because that's not their comfort zone. You know, like I said, if they stayed for a while, then the three cats amongst themselves would come to some sort of agreement and something else would happen. And the same is true for us. If you think about it, sitting down on a cushion like this, with nothing, there's no one threatening us, there's no sort of outside stress coming in. There's cars passing that doesn't involve us. There's a phone ringing, we don't have to bother with it. whatever else is happening, we don't have to do anything about it. But we manage to create all sorts of things when we're sitting on the cushion that become problems or difficulties, or we become bored, or we don't like the way that the person next to us is moving, or some aspect of the way that the bell is ringing, or you want the bell to ring sooner, or my back hurts, or it's too cold, or it's too hot, or anything. There are innumerable causes for discomfort. That's an example of how subtle and how the word insidious, I don't know if you can understand that, how pervasive, how wide-reaching this is in our existence. When we sit like this, we become more and more aware of it. By doing nothing, quote, nothing, we become more aware of everything that we do and everything that we create and that is stirred up. It's like the jar I used last night, the example. By sitting here, we become aware of it. And that's all we need to do. Just become aware of it. We don't need to take any action. Just sit and become aware. Become aware of when you're not aware. That's why I said last night, that important moment is when we're counting our breath and we suddenly realize we were no longer doing it. We were thinking about the cats. Or we were thinking about the meal the night before. Or we were thinking about how good we were doing counting. That's the important moment. That's when we become aware that we weren't aware. And then we're not aware again. That's okay, it doesn't matter. Come back again. Aware again. Now, this is, we call this a Zen retreat. I said I'm a teacher in a Zen tradition. We have some Zen forms that we're using, but it's very minimal. It may not seem to you that it is, if this is your first experience, but it really is compared to what some of the more traditional people use. But it doesn't, it's not about the forms, like I said this morning about the rituals. I could not wear all of this and be saying exactly the same thing to you and doing exactly the same thing. I will be honest, I chose to wear this week because it meant that I didn't have to bring any other clothing to sit in all the time. I wasn't going to bring it, and then I wanted to keep my suitcase small, and I realized that if I had to think about other clothes to wear while I was sitting, I would have to bring more things. So I thought, well, this is much easier. I'll just bring this. Although this is the traditional clothing that if I were practicing traditionally, I would wear when I was sitting. And this is a what we call a small version of what we think of as the Buddha's robe, the Buddha's, or a traditional, at that time in India, 2,500 years ago, a traditional piece of clothing for a holy man was what the Japanese call a kesa. It was a robe. And he wore that. That was what holy men wore, because it was simple and it was easy and it didn't involve having anything special. It very quickly became a symbol of something else. It became a symbol of the realization that this person, who we came to call the Buddha, which just means the awakened one, it became a symbol of his awakening. And his awakening is what I'm telling you. What he awoke to is exactly what I'm telling you. Nothing else. Nothing special apart from what I'm telling you. Meaning he awoke to this reality of his true self. I'm using different words than he used, but it's the same experience. So this robe became a symbol of that realization. And someone who then, we say, that was transmitted, the robe was given to someone else to symbolize that they had that realization and that they would then transmit it to other people. And then someone else would receive the robe and transmit it. And that's how it happened from generation to generation. I am the 84th generation in that chain, in our lineage, and it stretches all the way back to the Buddha. So this is a mini version of that. This is like a mini skirt or something. This represents the Buddha's robe. And the Buddha's robe represents the awakening, the realization. So I wear this when I teach when I'm in a practice setting like this, as a reminder of that. A reminder of that for myself, but also a reminder of that for others. It's at once an acknowledgement of an experience, but also an acknowledgement of the possibility that is available to every single person, anywhere, at any moment, to also awaken, to also experience that same realization. It doesn't require anything special. It doesn't require a certain position in society. It doesn't require working in a bank or living in a monastery. It doesn't require being a man or a woman or being educated or not educated, Portuguese, French, American, German, Mexican, Brazilian, Thai, Indian, doesn't matter. That experience is available to everyone at every moment because that's who you are. It's what you are. If it wasn't, well, then it wouldn't be available to anyone. But that's who you are. That's what you are. To awaken, however, requires, when I say awaken, it requires waking up. When you're asleep, you have to wake up. We have an alarm clock that wakes us up, or we have the timekeeper who wakes us up. But ultimately, that timekeeper is not waking us up. They're making a noise that we think will somehow intervene. Our ears will hear it, and then our brain will hear it, and then shake us out of sleep. But it's me who awakens. It's not the bell that awakens. It's not the alarm that awakens. It's me who awakens. The same thing with this practice. So I'm the equivalent of ringing the bell. I'm ringing the bell, I'm the alarm. All of the practices that we do are used for that same purpose. The eating, the way that we eat together, the work practice, the walking practice, the amount of sitting that we do, the silence that we keep, the simplicity, not having too many distractions, all of that is the equivalent of the alarm or the bell. But ultimately, it's you who wakes up. These things are all there to help you, but it's you who wakes up. Which, sometimes people hear that and they're very disappointed. And they think, oh no, that's horrible. I have to do this myself. But sometimes people hear it and they think, that's great news. That is really good news. I am fully free to do it or not. No one can keep me from waking up. No one can make me wake up. It's me. I am fully responsible for it. It's frightening to be fully responsible sometimes. That's true. Especially when it means waking up and we don't know how to wake up. We don't know how to do it. Do you know how you wake up in the morning? Do you know how you fall asleep at night? No. At some moment, it just happens. That's the same thing with this. At some moment, I'm aware. I see things as they are. At some moment, I'm counting, and I'm lost from counting, and suddenly, oh yes, I was counting and I was lost. We don't know how that happens. Doesn't matter how it happens. What's important is becoming aware of it. I don't know. I will go visit the cats again at some point and see how they're evolving. Or Louisa will tell me how they're evolving. Oh, they're much more comfortable today. Or they've been sitting by the window looking out at the spider. Or I don't know what they're doing. But I imagine there will be some evolution during the week with the cats. And I imagine that there will be some evolution during the week with us, with each of us. I say I imagine. My experience is that there is, that something happens by just sitting here minute after minute after minute. I don't know what that will be. None of us know what it will be, but something happens. And those of you who have been here before, who've done this practice or other practices, know that too. You don't know what. But you know that something happens. And probably we come back again because of whatever happened last time. It's sort of, sometimes it can be like childbirth where we forget all the difficult aspect of it. And there's this funny thing for other people here who have had children where it's fairly common, not long after giving birth, often a new mother wants to have another one right away. I mean, even within hours or days of having a child, of having gone through this unbelievably difficult experience, wants to have another one right away. Because the experience of giving birth is so powerful. And all of the difficulties involved, we forget. We didn't forget. We know they were we know it was difficult. But the powerful experience of giving birth was such that the rest of it doesn't matter. So maybe some people have come back here forgetting that they suffered and struggled and were tired and didn't like it, or their knees hurt, or I don't know, they were bored, or they didn't like the food, whatever, I don't know. Because something else happened. Or maybe they even, some people really like the difficulty and the pain. Or maybe they didn't have any difficulty and pain. I don't know. Everyone has their own experience. However, the retreat is, this is a very traditional structure of retreat. Maybe the forms of it are not so traditional, but the structure is traditional and is centuries old. And that's for a reason. That it works, if we can say something works. There's something in the natural flow of a human being that functions within this structure in a particular way. And it's been tried and it works. It works in the sense that it's the right amount of structure and rigidity without being too structured and rigid. Within the structure, anything can happen. When I'm sitting here talking, I arrived here today, I had no idea what I was going to say to you. Well, I had a vague idea. I thought, okay, this is the first idea, this is the first day. There are some people here who have no experience of this kind of practice. We're all starting out. We're all beginning today. So it was important to present sort of an introduction. But what that introduction would be, I didn't know. And I still don't. I'm just talking. But that's when the truth is really expressed. When we don't have an idea about what we should say or shouldn't say, what we want to say, what we don't want to say, what we think we should say, that's when the truth is really expressed, when we don't limit ourselves to those things. When we don't put walls around. So within the structure, anything is possible. When we sit down for 40 minutes, we have no idea what will happen in those 40 minutes. It's a wild adventure. Anything can happen, and does, within those 40 minutes. And when we're walking for 10 minutes, apparently just going in a circle, walking on the same floor again and again and again, anything can happen. And when I say anything, your experience of that moment is totally free. There's no limit to what you can experience in that moment. If you pay attention. If you're paying attention to your ideas about the moment, well then you will experience your ideas about the moment. But if you don't, if you're not clinging to your ideas about the moment, this is a perfect example. I'm holding something in my hand. I think I've got something. But if I open my hand, then it's no longer limited to just that one thing in my hand. I've taken down the walls and I have everything in my hand. So the cats, I keep coming back to the cats. Because they speak so clearly for us, the example of what we do. Are there any questions or comments, or did that bring anything up for you, or about something else too, if you have questions or comments? During the sitting periods, sometimes I go off in another room and people can come and have interviews. You can come and talk with me. And that's also a very traditional aspect of this Zen practice. Originally, those meetings with the teacher came about as a means of presenting one's of allowing the teacher to see where you were, what was happening, and having an experience of relating to another person in a way that is not limited by our usual structures that we put around a relationship. We both come to the encounter not knowing what will be, what will happen. We have no ideas, no position, fixed positions. So I still make that opportunity available, although it's optional. No one is required to do it, to come. And sometimes we call this an interview. And someone came to me once in an interview and said, so am I interviewing you or are you interviewing me? And that was an interesting point, because we have an idea about what an interview is. And this is not at all that. So it's not about, it's not like a job interview. It's not like I work as a journalist, and it's not like I'm a journalist interviewing me. We say interview in the sense of a meeting, say. A brief meeting. I say that so that you're aware of the fact that there are other moments when you can ask questions or to say what's happening for you, something like that. This is a moment for that, but there's also a moment individually. Now, sometimes at this moment in the day, I may not sit down and start talking. I may say, okay, it's question and answer today. So if no one asks any questions, I won't answer. Because really the questions are much more interesting than the answers, and much more alive. Today I think it was necessary for me to say what I said and do what I did, but it's not necessary every day. It doesn't have to happen that way. Because it's as important for the group to know where each of us is as it is for them to sit here and listen to me say whatever I'm saying. Although, it's different. Again, it's important to see the differences. But the differences are not qualitative. One is not better than the other. We say there is, in Buddhism, we say there is no high or low. Of course, there is, the ceiling is above the floor, but when we say it's not high or low, we're not saying that one is better than this one. And when we do start saying this is better than that, again, we come to the global financial crisis. The fact that some people, for the job they do in a company, should earn much, much, much more money than someone else that's performing a job as important to the company and doing it as well, should receive much, much, much less financially, there's something not... There's something, it's not a question of being right or wrong, it's missing the true nature of reality. It's fixing on just one, it's fixing on these differences. Rather than valuing everyone's contribution. No, I'm not here to talk about the global financial crisis. However, it's an example of the fact that what we do here, what I'm telling you, what this practice is about, is not some marginal, if there's nothing esoteric about it, what we think of as being spiritual is not marginal. It's not unimportant. It has real concrete effects in the material world. And it has real actual consequences in our individual lives. Not in a what we think of as a spiritual way only, in a very concrete material way. Because we are material beings. We are manifested in a very concrete material way. We are born and we will die. And we become sick. We grow old. There are differences. There are babies and there are old people. There are differences. However, this aspect that I'm talking about of the old woman I know is more youthful than some of the children I know, that is as real as what we think of as age, old, young. So I talk about the cats or the global financial crisis because it's a very clear example of what I'm talking about. And there are other examples of, the examples are endless. The way that the Dalai Lama deals with the question of China and Tibet, is also an example. And then the way that other nations deal with the Dalai Lama in China and Tibet is another example. France just recently, in the summer, France made China very upset because the president of France met with the Dalai Lama, and China was very, very upset and probably threatened to eliminate many, many commercial agreements and other sorts of political acts. And last week, France made peace with China by saying that they would in no way formally recognize Tibet. So, all of it we could trace that back to this notion of walls protecting oneself and one's self-interests, no matter what that consequences that has for others. Unless those consequences we think are favorable. So France thought it was much more favorable to have the consequences of China's happiness than to have the consequences of China's unhappiness. And France thought it was much more favorable to have the consequences of Tibet not being recognized than it was to have the consequences of Tibet being recognized. And that's no different than me choosing to devote my time to doing this instead of going to Jamaica or something. There's an action and there's a consequence. And we're free, each of us, to act, but then we have to take responsibility for the consequences of that action. This is what we call karma. You hear talk about karma, bad karma, good karma. There is no bad and good karma. There are actions and consequences. So, I don't know what time it is, but... okay. I think that's probably enough words for today, unless someone has a question or would like me to say something else. So now we have 20 minutes, well, 25 minutes probably. So we'll take a 5-minute break. Toilet, don't go too far away, whatever. And then we will sit again at 1:10. Yeah? Okay. Just for 20 minutes.